In a smart, glorious review to die for in the New York Times in 1969, John Leonard wrote of my argument with the Gestapo that the late Thomas Merton in 1941 used the war in Europe as a private Rorschach, the self as a real, locked into a projection booth while bombs came down on the movie house. For beyond a buffoonery is a horror, abstract and personal, he couldn't guess at while he wrote. And beyond language is silence, the silence he sought in his monastic vows, the silence he forsook to write the seven-story mountain, the poems, the Vietnam protests. The two primary things that preoccupied Tom Merton in 1941 were his deep and compelling yearning for religious life in the Roman Catholic priesthood, awakened around the time of his conversion and baptism in 1938, as well as, of course, the worldwide slaughter in what would finally be called World War II. His seemingly escapist response to those issues was to write what he then called the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis. What follows is a biography of that novel, showing that its fictional scenes in London and Paris, caught up in war, are in fact a psychogenic meditation on the state of the world and of the author's own warring soul, functioning as a factual examination of his past, just as it evinced his hopes for silence and seclusion in a Trappist future. Tom's first acquaintance with the Nazis at age 17 is recalled in the author's preface to my argument with the Gestapo. One Sunday morning in the spring of 1932, he wrote, I was hiking through the Rhine Valley. With a pack on my back, I was wandering down a quiet country road among flowering apple orchards near Koblenz. Suddenly, a car appeared and came down the road very fast. It was jammed with people. Almost before I had taken full notice of it, I realized it was coming straight at me and instinctively jumped into the ditch. The car passed and a cloud of leaflets from the ditch, I glimpsed its occupants, six or seven youths screaming and shaking their fists. They were Nazis and it was election day. I was being invited to vote for Hitler, who was not yet in power. These were the future officers of the SS. They vanished quickly. The road was once again perfectly silent and peaceful. But it was not the same road as before. It was now a road on which seven men had expressed their readiness to destroy me. That readiness to destroy was worldwide in 1939. And Tom sought to do exactly the opposite. St. Francis of Assisi prayed, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. And that may have nudged Tom into following the counsel of Dan Walsh, a visiting professor of medieval philosophy at Columbia, to consider a vocation to the priesthood in the order of Friars Minor, the Franciscans. And so, in October 1939, his baptism and confirmation as a Catholic, not yet a year old, Tom went to see Father Edmund Murphy, the Order's Provincial Secretary, then in residence at the Church of St. Francis of Assisi on 31st Street. Murphy was a hail fellow well-met who recognized Tom's piety, intelligence, and merry-eyed charm, and heartened him by saying he could foresee Tom joining fellow postulants at the novitiate of St. Anthony in August 1940. Elated, Tom decided a daily routine that imitated the Franciscan Ordo while continuing his studies for a doctorate in English literature at Columbia, with hopes of a dissertation on the religious poetry of the Jesuit Gerard Manley Hopkins. In 1939, Tom had begun an autobiographical novel that swelled to 500 pages. It was first titled The Straits of Dover, revised and renamed as The Night of the Battle, And finally, after breast surgery, the narrative was called The Labyrinth. While teaching classes in English composition at Columbia Extension School, he sought a publisher for the novel, submitting the typescript first to Farrar and Reinhardt, then Macmillan, Viking, Alfred A. Knopf, and Harcourt Brace, where junior editor Robert Giroux, an old friend from Columbia who later would become the editor of the seven-story novel, later recalled in print that this version of the mutable book was titled The Straits of Dover, and concerned a Cambridge Englishman who transferred to Columbia and got involved with a stupid millionaire, a showgirl, a Hindu mystic, and a left-winger in Greenwich Village. I agree with the other editors, Giroux wrote, that the author had talent, but the story wobbled and got nowhere. Either the rejections or his doctoral studies seem to have stalled Tom for a time, and he seems not to have returned to fiction writing even in the summer of 1940, when he again vacationed at the hillside cottage owned by Bob Lax's brother-in-law. Joining Lax and Tom that summer were also Eddie Rice, Jim McKnight, Cy Friedgood, Bob Gibney, and Bob Gurdy. Each had been associated with Columbia's undergraduate journal, Jester, and each wanted to be a writer. So they'd hauled their L.C. Smith and Royal portable typewriters up to the cottage to hammer out novels, listen to jazz, drink to excess, party with the pretty New York girls who visited, and wrangle over just and unjust wars and the world's impending doom. Still looking forward to becoming a Franciscan friar, Tom was often off by himself meditating in the woods, reciting the rosary or reading the Summa Theologica of Thomas Aquinas. But with the cottage so overpopulated, in June Tom walked down to St. Bonaventure College, then an all-male Franciscan school on 500 pastoral acres near the city of Orleans, and on the presumption of his entrance into the St. Anthony novitiate in August, he was permitted a room in the dormitory and got to know the friars while studying Franciscan history and practicing their way of life. Yet he was assailed by shame over his past sinfulness, especially at Cambridge University, where he roistered and sired a child out of wedlock, the very scandal that provoked his English guardian to send him across the Atlantic to Columbia after his freshman year. And Tom was aware he hadn't confessed such wickedness to the provincial secretary. So he took a grim train ride to the city and again interviewed with Father Edmund Murphy, penitently laying out the exact nature of his wrongs. And the worst possible outcome he could imagine was realized when an otherwise friendly, kindly, but shocked Father Murphy told him to withdraw his application to the Franciscans. Weeping and remorseful, Tom went for consolation to the sacrament of penance, confessing his misery to a Capuchin priest who jumped to conclusions about the religious hysteric beyond the grill, and in irritation said his pursuit of holy orders was henceforth out of the question. His yearned for vocation to the cloister and ordination, seemingly in ruins, Tom still professed his undying loyalty to the Friars Minor and returned to Olean. And in a second best solution, he was hired to teach three fall classes of a sophomore English literature survey at St. Bonaventure College, where, he wrote, the salary I got was quite sufficient to enable me to practice evangelical poverty, and where he would reside in Devereux Hall with, as he called them, football players with long, unpronounceable names. In the fall of 1940, Tom wrote a novel entitled The Man in the Sycamore Tree, about a character very like himself, who, as Paul M. Pearson describes him, writes stories and poems, is working on an M.A. on Blake, reads Gilson and Mary Tam, is melancholy, very pious, greatly troubled by the news from Europe, and is attracted to the priestly life. The book was rejected by his literary agency, Curtis Brown, and he himself admitted it was not very good. But he wrote, "So many bad books get printed, why can't my bad book be printed?" And in November, he viewed a 9-minute British propaganda film, "London Can Take It." It depicted 18 hours of Luftwaffe bombers, London's nightly visitors, systematically devastating 5 centuries of civilization in an effort to undermine Britain's morale. The documentary stated that the Blitzes fostered the opposite effect, as the stiff upper lip citizens kept to their ordinary chores and routines each morning, ever more determined to resist. The first seeds of the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis may have been planted then. "Bombs are beginning to fall into my life," Tom wrote in a journal entry. That wasn't true with Warsaw. I had never seen nor imagined Warsaw. But more terrible was seeing the line of people going down into the air raid shelter at dusk, then seeing the empty streets and an air raid warden walking slowly with his hands behind him in the sudden flash of a bomb, and hearing the sound of that air raid alarm. This, for the first time, made me want to fight. Soon after his 26th birthday, Tom became a lay member of the Franciscan Third Order, with the intent of living like a monk in the world, continuing his regimen of masses and confession, but also renouncing politics, giving up cigarettes, alcohol, and meat, wearing a brown scapular, and reciting the 7 canonical hours, or office, from his Latin breviaries. And at some crucial point, he again met with his mentor, Dan Walsh, and heard the professor describe with zeal the stirring retreats he took at the Cistercian Abbey of Our Lady of Gethsemane. His enthusiasm was enough to excite Tom into registering to go to Kentucky in April to be with the Trappists for Holy Week. "As soon as I thought about it," he wrote in his journal, "I saw that this was the only choice. That was where I needed to go. Something had opened out inside me in the last months, something that required, demanded at least a week in that silence. In that austerity, praying together with the monks in their cold choir, and my heart expanded with anticipation and happiness." As could have been expected, Tom was overwhelmed by the Holy Week experience, maintaining he had been residing there in the palace of the Queen of Heaven. In the 7 Mountains of Thomas Merton, biographer Michael Mott points out that in the 7 days that Tom was at Gethsemane, he wrote 23 pages in a large journal in celebration of the greatest discovery of his life. In terms of a sort of sustained rapture, nothing would ever be quite like this again. Revealing then that 3 weeks later, on May 6th, Tom began his last sustained work of fiction, The Journal of My Escape from the Nazis. In the 7-story mountain, Tom wrote that the journal was the kind of book that I liked to write, full of double talk and all kinds of fancy ideas that sounded like Franz Kafka. One reason why it was satisfying was that it fulfilled a kind of psychological necessity that had been pent up in me all through the last stages of the war because of my identification, my guilt, with what was going on in England. So I put myself there, and telescoping my own past with the air raids that were actually taking place as its result, I wrote this journal. And, as I say, it was something that I needed to write. Even though he was teaching a summer school session on bibliography, mostly to nuns, he must have maintained a high-speed output of 12 to 15 pages per day. For as soon as June 11th, he wrote in his journal that a first draft of the novel was already in the hands of Miss Burton, his agent at Curtis Brown. She may have gently commented on it in a way that urged him to revise. And on July 6th, like a guileless undergraduate in his first fiction writing class, he noted that his novel in progress has a definite form, Things seem to have to start in a certain way, and what I write has to have some conscious reference to something I wrote the day before. There is enough of a thread of connection to be embarrassing. Time considered the novel finally finished on the Feast of St. Clair, August 12th, and sent part of it to Chester Kerr, the editor at the Atlantic Monthly Press, who professed that he liked it but thought it wasn't commercial. What's commercial, Tom journaled? Even if the word means something to him, even then he isn't right. Publishers must be crazy. On the other hand, what does publication matter anyway? That final question had much to do with his flirtations with either helping the Russian baroness who founded Friendship House in Harlem, or forging ahead with the effort to join the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. The choice became simplified when, on the Friday after Thanksgiving, he had a luncheon meeting at the Columbia Faculty Club with Mark Van Doren. Their talk generally focused on Van Doren's reading of the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis. But on exiting the club, the English professor, who is not a Catholic, offhandedly asked whatever became of Tom's hope of becoming a priest. Tom could only shrug. Van Doren told him that the fact that he had let the idea of ordination fall away following just one rebuff, may have meant he had no vocation at all. Silently, Tom rejected that notion, for his longing felt permanent, but he recognized he may have been delaying and dilly-dallying, and it was high time to strive in earnest for his deepest desire. Taking leave of the president on 116th Street, of the professor on 116th Street, he told him, if I ever entered any monastery, it would be to become a Trappist. In fact, which religious community he joined was now not the aching question for him. It was about the possibility of holy orders itself. But then one night, he found his philosopher friend, Father Philotheus, and shared his dire questions. Tom wrote of that meeting. Instantly, he says that, in his opinion, there's no canonical impediment in my case. And he advised that Tom go again to Gethsemane as soon as the semester's Christmas vacation began and confess his problematic past and current inclination to the abbot, Dom Frederick Dunn. Still hedging a little, Tom wrote to request only a Christmas retreat with the Trappists, though he hinted that entrance as a postulant would be a consideration. And then on December 7th, the Imperial Japanese bombed the Pearl Harbor naval base, and on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, Adolf Hitler joined Japan in declaring war against the United States. And though it would seem like he was fleeing in cowardly fashion what he called the universal penance of military service and war, Tom needed out of an ever more chaotic and noisome world that too often seemed to want nothing at all to do with holiness and God. There followed a hurricane of activity as Tom arranged for other faculty to take over his English classes, shipped a closet full of clothes to Friendship House, gave away books and papers to the St. Bonaventure Library, sent his poems, journals, and the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis to Mark Van Doren for safekeeping, watched flames consume his other novel manuscripts, and filled just one suitcase with what army recruits call civvies, in which he hoped to soon replace with clerical attire. When Naomi Burton heard from Robert Lacks that Tom was joining the Trappist, the agent said in loss and misery, "Oh God, we'll never write again." She was quite wrong. Tom entered the Abbey on December 10th, was received in the novitiate on February 21st, 1942, and in 1944, his 30 poems was published. Three books by him came out in 1946, just as the Seven Story Mount was accepted by Bob Giroux at Harcourt Grace. And that autobiography became, of course, a phenomenon, selling 600,000 copies in its first year, and earning its silent, cloistered, contemplative monk an unpredictable international fame as he readied for holy orders on May 25th. And from then on, though he is given some minor chores like orientation classes for novices or the newly invented role of master of scholastics, his main job and a tremendous source of income for the abbey was his prolific writing. He averaged at least one book a year and published as many as 6 titles in 1948, 5 in 1949, 4 in 1953, 4 in 1956, 5 in 1958, and so on. Even though he still thought it a great loss that the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis was not in print, he seemed to have forgotten about trying to get the novel published until the Vietnam War was at its hottest and the peace-seeking Trappist sought a way to reorient the public mind. The first journal mention of his new hopes for the book appeared in 1967, on September 9th, when he recorded that, "I wanted to collect my thoughts but had to work in the afternoon finishing a rereading of the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis, which I want to get copied and submit for publication after all these years." Writing about the novel in his journal entry for February 8th, 1968, he noted that the typed manuscript of the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis seemed to have fallen to the floor but been put back together incorrectly so that incidents were confusingly out of order. But he wrote, "Whatever the mess, this is a book I am pleased with, this Journal of Escape. I have always thought of it as one of my best. Not that it holds together perfectly as a book, but there is good writing, and it comes from the center where I have really experienced myself and my life. It represents a very vital and crucial and fruitful moment of my existence. Perhaps now I'm turning to some such moment of breakthrough. I hope I am. I won't have many more chances." In 1968, an ominous last sentence. On May 14th, he wrote, "There was a letter from Naomi Burton who said that the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis passes from hand to hand at Doubleday, and nobody knows what to make of it. She likes it, but the rest are idiots." On June 23rd, he wrote, "Though there is very little enthusiasm at Doubleday over Journal of My Escape, Naomi has been authorized to make me an offer, and I am accepting it. Maybe I'm wrong. I think Doubleday is a bunch of nitwits, but Naomi likes the book and has fought hard for it, will continue to." Just a day later, Tom could write, "I have accepted an offer from Doubleday for a Journal of My Escape from the Nazis, though they are very cool towards it for the most part." Without prompting, in a letter to his agent on June 26th, he recorded a major change. "The reshuffled manuscript is on the way to the New York office with a new title, My Argument with the Gestapo. Could be subtitled A Macaronic Journey, 1941. Macaronic, or his other term, Esperanto, refers to the occasional mixture of Romance languages, German and street English, in a zany concoction born of the tomfoolery of James Joyce and P.G. Wodehouse. I found the passages unrewarding to puzzle out and easy to skip past. A more confident editor would have excised them." That the Journal of My Escape from the Nazis seems to have been impulsively retitled My Argument with the Gestapo possibly indicates that he first of all sought to differentiate the novel from the serially published journals that he suspected were the height of his literary achievement. And he may have wanted the hints of suspicion and danger associated with the Gestapo. But it must be said that neither title is wholly accurate or telling about the context of his book. The first implies an imprisonment by the SS, and perhaps a feat of daring do worthy of Steve McQueen and his fence-jumping motorcycle in The Great Escape. And My Argument with the Gestapo conjures up humorless secret police circled around a shackled man sitting under a glare of light as he disputes with a merciless interrogator. there would have been a wider audience for such pulp fiction. It could have resembled John Buchan spy thrillers that Tom avidly read as a teen in England. But Tom had to rely on his later worldwide celebrity rather than his characterizations or plotting to sell this particular book. As Monica Furlong wrote it, noted in Merton A Biography, My Argument with the Gestapo was a fascinating book, often brilliantly written in a rather Joycean style, and deeply interested in those interested in Merton. It does not really work as a novel, being unsteadily poised between fiction and autobiography, having neither the unity of the first nor the simple factual basis of the second. The narrator of My Argument with the Gestapo is Thomas James Merton, born like Tom in Preds, France, on January 31, 1915. Tom's finest entries in the narrative are deeply felt recollections of his childhood in France and his 7 years in England. But the book is otherwise an imaginary journey to those countries by a vigilant, perplexed, not quite American spectator who is often mistaken for a spy. He tells an officer interrogating him about biographical details, "If you want to identify me, ask me not where I live or what I like to eat or how I comb my hair, but ask me what I think I am living for in detail, and ask me what I think is keeping me from living fully for the thing I want to live for." The secular world was not asking those questions, but his heart was. In the author's preface, Tom wrote, "This novel is a kind of sardonic meditation on the world in which I then found myself, an attempt to define its predicament and my own place in it." A paragraph later, he added, "The reader must remember that it was dreamed in 1941, and that its tone of divertissement marks it as a document of a past era, by which he means there was no awareness of the concentration camps or Nazi massacres." The initial difficulty in getting the manuscript published in 1941 was exactly that it was dreamed, when during that same period, a host of reporters and filmmakers were vividly recording the stunning, harsh, life-altering realities of World War II in London and the French occupation. But few of those journalists could match the lilting cadence and concrete imagery of Tom's poetic prose. When asked by an ex-girlfriend what he will say of London, the character Thomas Merton states, "I will write about the small room I once slept in, one that smelled of fog and quilts and a temperance place. All night long I can hear water murmuring in the pipes in the wall, and the voices of old ladies came through the frail locked door. Thin voices of people roaming quietly on the stairs like wraiths of the Aeneid, gathering around a saucer of blood." With an epigraph by John Donne and allusions to Dante Alighieri, William Blake, T.S. Eliot, James Joyce, and Evelyn Waugh, it's the kind of book that many a doctoral student in English literature could have hoped to write. But Tom was far more than them, a gifted natural as a narrator, as when he descriptively lists the high points and low of his matriculation at Clare College, Cambridge. "I visited the proctor in his rooms in the new court of Magdalen and paid him a fine for not having a square. I had tea with some girls at Girton, sitting under a tree in some fairly long grass in the untidy part of the grounds. I had a friend who grew a beard. I read some of the works of the divine Dante. I was gated for 10 days in the Lent term for being drunk. I did cartoons in the Granta and the Gownsman. I sat in the writing room of the Union and wrote short, boastful letters to my younger brother." Thomas Merton, the character, is in London in 1941 to see what is happening. And he's rooming in the house of the cultured, wealthy, worldly-wise Madame Gongora and her English or his Spanish bodyguard, when he happens to meet too briefly B, his old girlfriend, and hear a sly nod to Dante's Beatrice. Beatrice. Much change now enforced into helmet and uniform, B inspires reminiscences of the O'Connor School in Rutland, dear friends he'd had, Charlie Chaplin films, and Anglican church services he grudgingly attended, preferring in contrast the candle and incense mysteries of the Catholic Mass and the discipline and integrity of the Trappists. The author's only allusion to what caused the Franciscans to reject his candidacy is offhandedly offered in a confession to a British agent when he tells him that I several times went out with a girl who was known all over Cambridge as the freshman's delight. Tom called the novel a kind of sardonic meditation on the world in which I then found myself, and that scornful derision in 1941 made the abnegations and erasures of monastic life far more welcome. Tom's own critique of the novel in 1951 was that one of the problems of the book was that my personal life in the world was my personal life in the world and to the war. When I wrote it, I thought I had a very supernatural solution. After 9 years in the monastery, I see that this was no solution at all. The false solution was this: the whole world, of which the war is a characteristic expression, is evil. It has, therefore, to be first ridiculed, then spat upon, and at last formally cursed. There is a good riddance and goodbye to all that quality to his memories of London, as if the rubble and destruction had laid bare what was licentious, stupid, tawdry, cruel, and hidden with shame behind a falsely respectable facade. And the journalist either imagines or is in fact being tailed by lurking detectives or investigators of unknown origin who suspect he's up to no good. The predicament that Tom was in was that of ridiculing or formally cursing the secular world as he felt an ever greater affinity for a buried life that seemed to contradict and deny all of his writerly ambitions. Worried about deportation or prison, in the novel, Thomas Merton crosses the English Channel in a torpedo boat, transfers onto a French fishing boat near Deauville, and hitches a ride to Abbeville in a truck full of happy German soldiers who claim their life is a dream, who feel forever young. Those jolly scamps are the only Nazis he ever encounters in the book. In Paris, the narrator hides out at the Hotel Amador, where Tom and his father Owen stayed in more palmy days. Again, he's questioned by detectives, quote, big, thick-necked, brutal men, Frenchmen that looked and behaved exactly like Germans. Editor Bob Giroux recalled that in the first novel he had read by Tom, the story wobbled and got nowhere. And so it is with my argument with the Gestapo. Our protagonist has his journal stolen and perused by censors, and then is led off to an investigation for which, to my great surprise, I emerged more or less free to go about in Paris as I pleased. It would thus seem a shaggy dog story, in which a rambling narrative leads to an inconsequential ending in which the Gestapo was never really run afoul of. The English novelist Ian Forster famously taught that the king died and then the queen died is a story. The king died and then the queen died of grief is a plot. We have no real plot, my argument with the Gestapo. Just a sequence of happenings, like glimpses of outdoor life from a hurtling passenger train. And the novel concludes not with an escape from the Nazis or an argument with the Gestapo, but a Kafkaesque conversation with an American correspondent for newspapers and broadcasting companies who presumes the character's journal is a pornographic diary. Thomas Merton surrenders the manuscript to this R in order to have it safely mailed to his New York agent from Lisbon. Meanwhile, he chooses to remain in France, his first home, and home too, of course, of the first Cistercian monastery, Le Grand Trap. Even if unconscious, some such connections could not have been out of Tom's mind. In the New York Times of July 10, 1969, John Leonard extolled my argument with the Gestapo by noting, compounded in equal parts of autobiography, spiritual passage, and incantatory tour de force. It is less a conventional novel than the word drunk, panic-stricken, sorrowful, hilarious journal of a man hounded by and hounding after the idea of God. That hounded by and hounding after is a crucial insight about an intriguing and exuberant novel-like thing originally composed during a period of intense spiritual torment. It was something that I needed to write, Tom said, a sort of exorcism. Seen in that way, the Gestapo represent all the negative, policing, scoffing enemies of religious life who sought to impede and undermine his vocation, letting him shirk the responsibilities of his calling. My argument can be viewed as an interior monologue about Tom's conflicted hankering, vacillation, uncertainty, and the naysaying voices that seem to be railing against him. And the journal of my escape from the Nazis was essentially a journal of his wistful intention to find solitude, renounce the world, and give up everything, even his writing talent, for a God who was the solace to us, the only you that didn't really matter to him. Thank you.